Gary Nall. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Our theme today, the real Syrian narrative, cutting through the American mainstream misinformation and lies. Two guests from Seattle, Washington. We will have Jerry Condon. Jerry is the Vice President for the Executive Committee of Veterans for Peace, an international nonprofit composed of military veterans, their families and allies, dedicated to building a culture of peace and to expose the true cost of war and conflict. He is a Vietnam-era veteran and also a war resister who spent 6 years in Sweden and Canada for refusing orders to fight in Vietnam. Jerry has a long history of veterans peace activism, having organized the first veterans delegations to revolutionary Nicaragua in 1983 and 84. From 1993 to 94, he worked for Pastors for Peace to organize humanitarian aid and political solidarity, caravans to Cuba. For the past dozen years, he has been on the front line supporting war resisters in Canada, Germany, and the U.S., and elsewhere, from going to Afghanistan and Iraq. His website is veteransforpeace.org. He'll be joined in Connecticut with Dr. Henry Lowendorf. Dr. Lowendorf is on the executive board of the U.S. Peace Council. He is a pro-worker, anti-imperialist, peace organization, activist. This organization, the U.S. Peace Council, was founded in 1979 and is committed to social justice and the elimination of weapons of mass destruction. The Council is a member of the U.N. under its affiliation with the world's largest peace organization, the World Peace Council. He is the chair of the Greater New Haven Peace Council, a position he's held since 1985, and he also held a career as associate director of technology assessment and research at Yale University for over 20 years. He holds degrees in cell biology, University of Michigan, and a doctorate in biology from Case Western University. His organization's website is uspeacecouncil.org. And he has many news announcements and articles on that site. I'd like to welcome both of you to our program.
Hello.
Hi.
This
Jerry
is
Henry. And Henry.
Hi,
Henry.
This is Jerry out on the West Coast. Thanks so much for having us, Gary.
Yes,
good.
Thank you.
I'm going to begin with you, Henry. Last July, both of you, along with five other peace activists and journalists, returned from a fact-finding and peace mission to Syria. I understand you spoke with and interviewed many Syrian citizens who had been affected by the wages of war and the crimes of terrorist groups. You met with Syrian President Bashar Assad for 2 hours, as well as other governmental agents, and Syria's Grand Mufti, Ahmad Hassan. And apparently, you were able to try to look in on Aleppo, but we're not able to get there, understandably so, because now it's the scene of a great deal of conflict and international controversy. However, earlier today we tried to speak with Eva Bartlett in Lebanon, but we're not able to get a connection that was audible. So we'll have her on a different program. But Eva had visited Aleppo several times. Nevertheless, what we want to know is something that you've experienced, that the mainstream media refuses to discuss, even the alternative media refuses to discuss, and that is that we have been misled on the information in Syria. When our news outlets report on events in Syria and report on who did what, we can, with a great deal of assurance, agree this largely fabricated analysis. In fact, the U.S. and its Western coalition allies are supporting terrorist jihadist organizations, and in general, the Syrian people want us out of there. The U.S. is not perceived as liberators, and President Assad continues to have massive support in the population. So given your personal research and firsthand experience in Syria, I'm hoping you can enlighten listeners to what is really unfolding in Syria and help us all try to understand why. Help us understand what the ultimate goal is behind the U.S. intervention, now destroying an extremely rich culture that was once stable, progressive, secular, and maintain harmony between many religions and sects before the U.S. targeted Syria for regime change. And based upon your interviewing and meeting average Syrians, many of whom have been victims in some way or another of the fighting, how would you summarize the majority of Syrian wishes and desires vis-a-vis alternative rule of the land that would ensue if the U.S. supported Salafi organizations, if they were to become victorious? In other words, for the person listening, what happens if Hillary Clinton is elected president? She's already stated her intentions to have no-fly zones, just as she did in Libya. Look at Libya today. I believe that we would see equally bad circumstances in Syria. I believe that that would make room for Saudi Arabia and the most extreme elements, Wahhabist, the terrorist group, al-Nusra, ISIS, ISIL. I believe others would reach in there to fill the gap and exploit its resources, including Turkey. So I believe it would be a bloodbath, and yet the mainstream media refuses to discuss this. Please take us on this journey now, including a history of Syria for those who are not familiar with it prior to this turn of events. The forum is yours.
Thank you. I think you've given a pretty good summary of our view of what was going on before we went to Syria, and the purpose of the delegation was to get a conversation started in the United States, because not only do we have the government of the United States trying to overthrow the elected government and the UN-recognized government of Syria, that is, President Assad is the head of that government. Not only is that the case, but the peace movement in the United States has been split and paralyzed and unable to do anything to stop this war on Syria, because too many people in the peace movement have bought the massive propaganda that overshadows the reality of what the United States is doing. So we understood that in too many cases, the United States has invaded other countries and overthrown their governments. And often the preparation for that is to demonize the government and the head of the government as some kind of brutal dictator. And in this case, Assad has been he has been demonized to such an extent that way too many people buy that and then ignore the fact that the U.S. is trying to overthrow his government and the government of the people of Syria by violence, and in this case, largely mercenaries that are hired. Many of them are jihadists, but not all of them. We learn, for example, that many of the people who are fighting on the side of ISIS and al-Qaeda and al-Nusra and the other named organizations are, in fact, not particularly religious. They're there for adventure. They're there because they have been left out of society. Those were some of the descriptions that we heard from a number of people we interviewed. In fact, the Syrian government said if the United States were really interested in getting rid of these terrorists, it would collaborate with the Syrian government because it has a wonderful database that covers who these terrorists are, where they're coming from. So the underlying basis for our trip was to get a discussion going and to start trying to get past this massive propaganda industry that has clouded what actually is happening. We found absolutely consistent a number of things that I was not aware of. I'm not a historian, and my knowledge of Syria and often my knowledge of other countries is similar to that of many people in our country. We learn about them when there's a war that the United States has started, and we start learning about them. But we heard from many, many people that Syria is a very united country, and the various groups that we identify, Christians, Muslims, the various sects of the Muslim religion, Yazidis, Kurds, and so forth, they don't talk to each other as if they're part of a different group. They look at each other and they recognize them as Syrian. And we were told that by many people, including the Grand Mufti, who we spent a good amount of time with, and the Orthodox bishops that we talked to. When we met with them, both said that, the Grand Mufti was asked, well, how many Muslims are there? And he said, I'm not the Mufti for the Muslims. I'm the Mufti for 23 million Syrians. That's the total population. And the Orthodox bishop said the same thing. They share religious holidays. They are in and out of each other's religious institutions. They're good friends. And what they're trying to avoid, above all, which is what the United States is trying to create, is to divide up the country into these different groupings as a means of conquering and overcoming the country and being able to install a client regime, as it has in so many other countries. The Syrians are well aware of that. Actually, you can find historical documents and writings that indicate that Syria is a very secular country. It sees itself, people in Syria see themselves as Syrians. They don't see themselves in these divided groups that the United States wants to create. So those were some of the things that we learned. We had some wonderful conversations with people. Perhaps Jerry would like to add to what I've said here. You raised a lot of different issues, and clearly this is a large topic.
All right. Jerry, give us your perspective, please.
Well, I was happy to join this delegation, which was organized by the U.S. Peace Council and representing Veterans for Peace, and Veterans for Peace certainly wanted to have a better look at what was going on on the ground in Syria. Our mission is actually nothing short than to abolish war, and in the meantime, to restrain our government from intervening overtly or covertly in the internal affairs of other nations. Well, so, of course, we have opposed the ongoing U.S. war and occupation in Afghanistan. We opposed the U.S. invasion and occupation of Iraq. We saw the lies that facilitated popular support in the early stages of that war. And we see this continuing. We listened carefully to when General Wesley Clark reported on his visit to the Pentagon, where he was informed that there was a plan to overthrow seven Middle Eastern and Northern African countries in 5 years. That was starting with Iraq, and then Syria, Lebanon, Libya, Somalia, Sudan, and finishing off with the grand prize of Iran. So we take this seriously, and we see very much the Syrian war in that context, and it's kind of shocking that so many otherwise well-informed people, including peace activists who've watched all of these wars unfold, somehow look at Syria differently, that the propaganda has been so effective and so pervasive, and appearing in all kinds of places, even some progressive media. And it's hard for people not to think that, there must be some truth to this, that Assad is gassing and killing his own people, and he's a monster, and maybe there is a justification for some kind of humanitarian intervention, which is the latest rationalization for imperialist adventures in the Middle East. And you know, we had these strong suspicions about the nature of the war before we went. There's plenty of information available, if you look for it, that shows that the U.S. has been cultivating so-called moderate rebels, providing them with training and arms, and they have not been very successful at it. There's a lot of information now that shows us that these so-called moderate rebels are virtually indistinguishable from terrorists of Al-Qaeda and ISIS. And so we know these things are going on. Unfortunately, Syria has apparently quite a melange of enemies that have collaborated in this attempt to overthrow the secular, multi-religious Syrian state. And they include not just the United States, who's obviously actively involved, but also Saudi Arabia and Qatar. Qatar has reportedly put something like $100 billion into this effort. That sounds like an incredible number, but I believe that's what I've read. Maybe it's 100 million, but it's a whole lot of money. The Saudi Arabia and Qatar are providing more of the financial support, the U.S. providing some of the military support and political cover. Turkey has been involved, and we also know from speaking to a number of people in Damascus that they believe that behind much of this intervention also lies Israel. You ask, you know, what are the reasons why people would want to be overthrowing the Syrian government? Well, one of the main reasons is the same reason that every other Middle Eastern country has been aggressed against, and that is over control of oil. Sounds rather simplistic, and to some extent it is, because there are other reasons as well. That have to do with power in the region and hegemony for Israel and the U.S. and NATO, the former colonial powers trying to reestablish themselves in the Middle East and remake it in their own image. So we found much corroboration for this when we were in Damascus. We met with quite a broad range of folks, including a number of government ministries who gave us very good briefings about, in their various areas of concern. The Minister of Health, for example, who told us about how the sanctions, the economic sanctions imposed by the U.S. and the European Union are causing great damage to average Syrian civilians, including especially in the health sector. And we heard a lot about even though Syria actually manufactures much of its own medications, they don't have access to much-needed cancer medicines that have been blocked by these sanctions. So we heard from both government people and non-governmental people. We talked to Lawyers Association, the Students Association, to the religious leaders that were mentioned, and others, NGOs. And we heard that they were almost equally concerned with the economic sanctions. So I think it's important that we talk about that, as they were with the ongoing U.S. support for terrorism. And that's how they see the war. They see they are very emphatic that this is not a civil war. This is a foreign-imposed war. It is foreign finance, and it is foreign-led. Henry referred to the fact that there are actually, jihadists and other mercenaries coming from in excess of 90-some countries around the world. That's why the Syrians say they have a great database. Many of them coming from Europe, actually. And, in fact, we were told that the head of al-Nusra, the al-Qaeda front in Syria, which has changed its name yet again recently, it was actually from Norway. It's a Norwegian citizen. And many disaffected people from Muslim communities throughout Europe that have not been well integrated into those societies, to say the least, are joining this war for jihad or for glory or just for adventure, as Henry said, believe it or not, and, of course, for money. A lot of forces, there are a number of proxy wars going on that are in the mix here between Saudi Arabia and Iran are both vying for influence in the region, and Saudi Arabia sees Syria as an ally of Iran and as a secular society where it would rather impose a strict fundamentalist Muslim order on Syria. The United States and Israel have taken advantage of these dynamics and have stirred them up, have fed them, have brought a lot of money and terror to the situation. And, you know, the Syrian people are in the grip of great terror. And despite what you read in the U.S. media, most of that terror is not coming from the Syrian government by any means. And when we arrived in Damascus, we found a huge, sprawling, peaceful, normally functioning metropolis, the ancient city for sure. And, you know, we barely saw any armed men or men in uniform, which is pretty surprising. It's hardly an occupied place, and it didn't seem like it was even on a war footing for the most part. However, the first night we were there, a mortar was fired from a nearby suburb, landed in the old town, and killed 8 people, men, women, and children, in a restaurant there. And we were told that hadn't happened in several months. Things had been relatively quiet in Damascus area. A couple of days later, a truck bomb went off in the middle of the town. These are acts of terrorism. And that is the nature of the war against the Syrian people. Although in a much larger scale in places like Aleppo and other parts of the country, when the mortar landed and the 8 people were killed, I heard a Syrian made kind of a comment, "I bet you're not going to hear about this on CNN or any of the other U.S. media." And he was right. There was no mention of that whatsoever. There's no mention of the fact that the Nusra terrorists who are ensconced in parts of East Aleppo are regularly firing mortars and rockets and other weapons of significant destruction into civilian neighborhoods of Western Aleppo. You don't hear about that. All of a sudden, all you hear about is bombs raining down on poor babies in Eastern Aleppo from Syrian and Russian planes. In other words, every time that the Syrian government and its allies try to defend themselves against this terrorist invasion, they are the ones that are suddenly there's this hysterical reaction in the West about this humanitarian disaster and this horrible Guernica that's taking place in Aleppo. And, of course, it is horrible. A war is a horrible and an unacceptable thing. We cannot applaud one side or the other when there's bombs raining and when civilians are caught in the middle, as they normally are. As I said before, Veterans for Peace believes we should abolish war altogether. We have no right to tell a country that it can't defend itself.
Jerry, hold your thoughts for a moment, because I'm going to put this in a little larger context now. There was a time when Syria was considered the breadbasket of the Middle East. Mm-hmm. It had done a great deal for women. It gave women, like Libya, the full freedom to explore their professions and not be limited living under a man's rule, a patriarchal rule. It mm-hmm. also they had one of the highest rates of women graduating from college of any country in the Middle East, or Africa mm-hmm. for that matter. They built over 5,000 hospitals, university colleges, and were allowing as little as $35 a year to go to college. So for all intents and purposes, they had free education, free health care. They also did not have malnutrition. They also were not tolerant of extremism, but they were a very secular, open society, especially considering what was around them in the Middle East. Now, in that context, we have to understand that the United States, prior to 9/11, according to General Clark, who was the head commander of NATO prior to that, had stated that they wanted a regime change. Now, we had already had regime change in many other South American, Central American countries, and we thought it would be a relatively quick slam dunk. It was not. It has cost us upwards, according to Dr. Joseph Stiglitz, a professor, Nobel Prize winner, upwards of $5 trillion in just Iraq and Afghanistan, when you consider also the long-term health care cost of those who've been injured. We also, in the case of Syria, we had, after invading Libya, which, by the way, forget Gaddafi for a moment, whether you like him or not like him. The facts are the facts. Of the 54 countries in Africa, his was number one. It had the highest literacy rate in Africa, if not the Middle East, including that includes even greater than Israel. It had absolute freedom of women, and they participated in a multi-democracy by committee. Everything that was done in Libya was done by local committees, and no one would be excluded. The monies that came in from their oil, which was a light crude instead of a dark crude, so it was more valuable. Syria's is not as good. Went into central banks and then was divided into the country's individual bank accounts. Free education, free medical care. You got a stipend when you were married and had a child. There was child leave. If you wanted a farm, you were given your tools, implements. The farm was purchased for you. They had zero unemployment, and most importantly, up until about 2 years before they were invaded, except for Benghazi, which was a hotbed of terrorist activity, it was not a police state. And people would go there as if this were the Paris of Africa. And he also had the largest man-made waterworks project in the world. It dwarfed anything we've ever done in the United States. It dwarfed the things we were proud of, and rightly so, like the Hoover Dam, because he had an aquifer system that would feed over 200 million Africans their water who had no water, little or no water. And this was a gift to them. He wasn't charging them for this, and he paid for that. So on every level, age, they lived the longest. They had the longest lifespan. They had high literacy rate. They had freedom. All religions were tolerated, but extremism was not. And so that's the country that represented no threat to the United States. But what did cause this threat? The gold denier. What caused another part of the threat? Uniting other African countries to go off the dollar as the currency in oil and go to the gold denier, in effect have their own currency. That scared the United States and its allies. But also now under WikiLeaks, we've seen documents where France under Sarkozy and England under Cameron, and initially, I think, Berlusconi in Italy, they all had something they wanted from Libya. Now, even though we're talking about Syria, the same principal parties apply. They were all involved. NATO was involved. Now, NATO should have been disbanded. It's a criminal organization. After the end of the Cold War, back in 1991, it should have been abandoned. It was not. It's increased. And all the promises made with Gorbachev to stop with Bush Sr. and Gorbachev to stop any further encroachment has been abandoned. Now we have all these war games and trying to cause regime change in the Crimea. And Hillary Clinton was behind that. So now they destroy a country that was prosperous. And now that's the hotbed of terrorist activity. But on top of that, a secret was going on. The CIA, along with the National Security Agency and the State Department, were taking Gaddafi's weapons through Ambassador Stevens and then shipping those on a regular basis into Syria to be used by the terrorists in Syria against Assad and his regime. Others were going into Turkey. Now, there's our ally. Here's Turkey, member of NATO, has one of the largest standing armies in the Middle East, right up there with Saudi Arabia, and a large country, and yet it is being ruled by a theocrat, someone who got in under the principles of breaking corruption and sharing power, and then consolidated power, and is in alignment with Wahhabism and the most radical forms of Sunniism, and is aligned with Saudi Arabia. So now they are actually holding hospitals just for people in the Syrian conflict. So you go into Syria as a terrorist, you're trained and armed by the CIA and the Turkish government, you now are a terrorist, you go in, you attack towns, you attack people, and we're funded. The U.S. press, the New York Times, the MSNBC will all align saying that these are good freedom fighters. No, that's like calling that's like calling Somoza's Nicaraguan National Guard Contras good freedom fighters. Reagan compared them to our founding fathers. No, they were terrorists. They were just mercenary terrorists. And yet that's the power of the press to change the story. So now we have terrorists being funded by the United States, armed by Gaddafi, the weapons he bought from us, but when we destroy the country, we're using those weapons, putting them into Syria. Turkey is now allowing up to 12 to 14,000 tankers to go into Syria, steal Syria's oil, then go into northern Iraq, steal Iraq's oil, bring it back into Turkey, where the son of the president, Erdogan's son, is then selling this on the black market, including selling it to Israel for $20 a barrel, way under the $40 to $50 a barrel at the time, or even higher. Huge black market. That money, up to $4 million a day, is going to ISIS and al-Nusra to fund them. So at no time in 14 months, not once, did the United States Defense Department, Intelligence Agency, the National Security Agency, overseeing all this, and the CIA, target those trucks. Yet we're saying we want to stop terrorism. Well, stop its funding. We didn't do that. Russia comes in and destroys the tankers and stops one of their sources of income. Then they go after them. The very people like al-Nusra that we had not bombed and not destroyed, Russia's bombing him. And then it was only because of Russia entering that I believe within 6 weeks the Assads would have been assassinated, the country overtaken, and then all that we had seen in Libya would happen in Syria. Now, so Assad, it was proven by an investigative report by one of the greatest investigative journalists of all times. You know who I'm talking about, right?
Who wrote Seymour Hersh.
Seymour Hersh, who wrote that it was not Assad using chemical weapons on his citizens. It was the terrorist, and the French were cooperating with him. By the way, these are the same French that the French intelligence service intentionally, with malice aforethought, destroyed a Greenpeace ship, killing people, and nobody went to jail because of it. Mm-hmm. So much for the immunity for those who are in power. So now what you have is you have Assad having some protection from Iran, having some protection from Lebanon, from Hezbollah, and most importantly from Russia. So then that shifted the balance. Now all you hear is about how bad Russia is. Suddenly Russia became the bad people in this, and Putin became the terrorist and equated by Hillary Clinton as Hitler, not even looking at what had happened as the facts on the ground. So now we have a moment where the Syrian people, over 58% support Assad, and they have a Grand Mufti. Now, the Grand Mufti, this Grand Mufti Hassoun, and he's been there from 2007. Now, keep in mind, one of his redeeming characteristics is his radical tolerance and respect for the different religions and sects. He's often criticized by Muslims in the Arab world for his deep involvement in interfaith dialogue. This was a reason President Assad selected him to this position. Not unlike Libya, under Gaddafi, the government does not tolerate any Islamic fundamentalist extremism. But I feel this desire for interreligious harmony exemplifies Syrian secular culture in general under the Ba'athist government. Here's what he said, quote, "I follow all sects of Islam. I am a Sunni in practice. I am a Shiite in alliance. My roots are Salafi, and my purity is Sufi," which is the mystical side of Islam. So would you speak about the culture of plurality and tolerance that Syria embodied in the Middle East, because this culture of diversity and harmony is rather unique to Syria when compared to, let's say, our number one ally, Saudi Arabia? Saudi Arabia will throw homosexuals off buildings, yet Hillary Clinton is out there trying to garner the gay vote and saying she's with them. Well, when did you confront them about their homophobia? In Saudi Arabia, they took the completely peaceful religious leader of that entire area of Saudi Arabia and both beheaded him and crucified him. He committed no crime. Women have been lashed to death. They do more beheadings this year than ISIS, and yet under Kerry, they were appointed to head the Human Rights Commission at the United Nations.
Let me take a shot at some of those things. That's, again, a large list of things to talk about. Certainly one of the things that we found prevalent, not just from the religious leaders, but everybody else we talked with in Syria, was this respect for everyone. And really, they didn't care. The Syrians didn't care whether you were Muslim or Christian or whatever. That wasn't on their list of questions when they met people. They respected everybody as Syrians. They looked at everybody as Syrians. And one of the things they said was, you know, Syria is one of the oldest civilizations in the world, and for several thousand years, people have had to get along, and they have. So the effort to divide them up, as I pointed out before, is an externally created effort. We were lucky enough to be able to tour a village outside of Damascus called Malula, and Malula is a shrine. It's a shrine to Saint Tekla, and there's a whole story about how this shrine was created several thousand years ago. And there's a church around the shrine, and people go there to be healed and to be comforted and all of the things that people go to shrines for. But this village had been attacked by the terrorists, and there were many things destroyed, but in particular they came into this Christian shrine, and the terrorists consciously destroyed the icons, the crosses, the pictures of Jesus, the pictures of the saint, the mosaics. They consciously destroyed those and vandalized this whole church. While we were there, this village speaks Aramaic. This is the language of Jesus. It is not Arabic. It's not Hebrew. It's a language of itself, and obviously an ancient language. They speak this language, and they gave the Lord's Prayer in Aramaic for us, and the Muslims in the group and the Orthodox bishops in the group and everybody who knew, who lived there and also had come with us, aside from the North Americans, spoke this. They gave this all at the same time because they respected each other and because they felt that all of these religions were related to each other and all of the groups are related to each other and they're part of the Syrian culture. So we were very impressed with this notion that the divisions that the U.S. is trying to create are anathema to the people of Syria. They don't want to see this. There are people who opposed Assad as the president of Syria and held nonviolent demonstrations in 2011. And those nonviolent demonstrations were infiltrated by men with guns, men with heavy weapons. And as you point out, some of these weapons came from Libya. The nonviolent demonstrators stopped their demonstrations because they did not want to be associated with the violent extremists who the United States and its allies in the Middle East and NATO allies are supporting. So now we have the nonviolent opposition actually supporting the government in a sense of unity, national unity, to oppose these terrorists that the United States is supporting. We met with the Minister of Reconciliation. It's a ministry or a department of the government that the United States does not have. It's sort of inconceivable currently to think the United States would have a whole department, a cabinet-level department, focused on reconciliation. And we know how much this country needs some reconciliation at this point. The head of that ministry is Ali Haidar. He is the leader of the main opposition party, and he was leading the nonviolent demonstrations before the gunmen came in. He was leading those, and he has become part of the government. So what you have now, and we spoke to people who were in the opposition, that is, they're part of opposition parties, and they have criticisms of the Assad government. And by the way, I listen to you speak of it as the regime. I think it's important not to accept this terminology. We don't talk about the. I hope we don't talk about the Obama regime. It's Obama's administration. It's the Obama government. Regime is an attempt to part of the demonization that degrade the value of this government. Assad's government has opposition people in it. The parliament has opposition parties in it. It is not the kind of government that we're used to. It's a different kind of government. The United States has a lot of arrogance in trying to impose its form of government on other people when they have functioning governments. It's up to the Syrians to decide who will rule Syria, who will govern Syria. It is not up to the U.S. State Department. It's not up to the Pentagon. It's not up to the people who vote in the United States elections to decide who will govern Syria. That was consistent with everybody we spoke with. People we spoke with informally, people we spoke with formally, people we met with. As Jerry said, we met with a lot of groups. We also met with the Business and Industry Council. They're basically their Chamber of Commerce. Major businessmen and women who gave us information about how sanctions are hurting their businesses. They're hurting their ability to keep the businesses going. Many of them had industries and companies in the areas that were taken over by the terrorists, and the terrorists took these industries and took the machinery and stole it and sold it off in Turkey. They sold it in Turkey, as they've been selling the oil in Turkey. And so these business people had to try to start up again in the Syrian government-secured areas, and of course they were having a hard time getting machinery and parts and technicians and so forth to run their machinery. So the sanctions that Jerry mentioned as a key element in the U.S. war on Syria to weaken the country for overthrow, to get the people of the country to get so angry that they will overthrow their government or allow the United States to overthrow it, those sanctions are hurting the mass civilian population of Syria. It's medicines, it's parts for kidney machines. It's all sorts of machinery and parts for machinery. Syria was very self-sufficient in many ways, as you pointed out, the breadbasket. We could talk about how the environmental crisis that we face, global warming, has influenced the civil life in Syria and caused people to be angry with the government, which in part was what led to the nonviolent demonstrations in 2011. So these sanctions are these sanctions are hurting the people. The United States, as you pointed out, has overthrown governments all over the world, and they have. The United States cannot point to governments that it has overthrown and replaced as being better off, the people being better off for the governments that the U.S. has installed. And we can name a lot of them beyond the ones that you named and throughout the world. So our major conclusion is that it is not a civil war any more than Vietnam was a civil war, or Nicaragua with the Contras was a civil war, or the Bay of Pigs in Cuba was a civil war. These were wars that were instituted by outside forces, primarily the United States. And so this is a war to overthrow the government. And part of the reason that and President Obama constantly says this, he repeats this, we want regime change. The recent ceasefire that the United States and Russia negotiated collapsed because, in fact, there are parts of the U.S. government that don't want a ceasefire. They want the war to expand. As you pointed out, Hillary Clinton has called for no-fly zone, which is basically to bring the United States troops and military even more than it is already engaged in this war, and expand it and make the situation far worse than it is already. So we have people in the U.S. government and in the U.S. beyond the government that want to see U.S. troops there. They want to see a bigger war. They have bought into this propaganda industry. They have no hesitancy. And there are other people who say that's not going to be successful. It won't work, and it will cost us a lot. One of the things that the Peace Council has emphasized, and we repeat this and try to emphasize this, is that right now, with Russia on the front lines of this war and the U.S. bombing with its own air force, that an accident or an intentional attack by one on the other, the United States and Russia, could escalate into a nuclear confrontation. The U.S. and Russia hold 95% of the world's nuclear arsenal, and the United States is surrounding Russia and it's surrounding China with troops, missiles, bases, and threatening those countries, and any kind of accident, any kind of shooting down a plane or a tank driver going across the border, any of these things could lead to a confrontation and an escalation that go nuclear. This is not just the war in Syria that's taking place. This is an enormous threat to global peace. It's an enormous threat to global civilization. And too many people are not looking at the consequences of continuing the war and expanding the war. This is something that we need to do, we need to look at, and we need to stop. We need to find ways of stopping what's going on. As Jerry said, we need to stop this war as one way of, one piece of the effort of stopping all wars. We need to stop this war. And that means that we need to tell the United States to back off. Hands off Syria. Get out of there. Take your allies with you.
I fully agree with you, Henry. The trouble is that the neocons, which control Washington, D.C., for all intents and purposes, and have enormous influence in the media and the think tanks, they see this as a business opportunity or an ideological shift that benefits them. Now, you made a couple of comments. One was that about the sanctions and what the sanctions would mean and have meant for the people. Let us not forget the sanctions that the Clintons, as co-presidents, put in place in 1991 in Iraq. More than 500,000 children minimally, as high as 675,000 children, I was later told, died because of these sanctions. Then we saw documents that show that the Clinton administration authorized the Defense Department to take out civilian infrastructure, including power plants, water purification plants, and that's against the Geneva Convention. That can get you into crimes against humanity, and yet we refuse to acknowledge that killing 500,000 children was a bad thing. Even Madeleine Albright on 60 Minutes said, was it worth it? And she said, yeah, well, it wasn't worth it for the kids, and it would have been different if those were 500,000 American kids. So we can only imagine, as you suggested, how challenging it is for the Syrian people to have to live with all these sanctions, in addition to the uncertainty of when that next rocket that you mentioned would go off and kill people having dinner, and the lack of medical supplies, the lack of equipment, the blocking of all this aid. And there are 13 million Syrians depending upon that aid to survive. And Syria has been under U.S. sanctions since 1979. But only 2011, with the Arab Spring uprising, has the U.S. increased them, and including Syrian banks, so that no one in the outside world can do business with Syrians. And in terms of the quality of life you saw among Syrians, you also notice the adverse effects of U.S. sanctions. And since the Arab Spring, the Syrian government, including the Grand Mufti, have constantly stated that many of the protesters were actually armed, as you mentioned. And these were armed Islamist rebels backed by Saudi Arabia and Turkey that had infiltrated the peaceful demonstrations inside of Syria. And the United States government has never addressed the fact that we support anyone infiltrating, arming and infiltrating peaceful demonstrations. We didn't acknowledge it in any of the other countries, but we should. That's a legitimate question. So back to you, Jerry. We're running short on time now, so I'd like for you to address this as quickly as you can. Please clear up for us the confusion about different Salafi terrorist organizations, such as Al-Qaeda, which are the so-called moderates, being funded and armed and fully supported by the United States government, and then, of course, ISIS or Daesh, and which is the relationship between them? And if we know for a fact that the U.S. is aiding certain jihadi terrorist groups, such as al-Nusra, which has now been renamed into al-Sham to keep people confused, to topple the Syrian government, then how much does this then indirectly or directly indict the U.S. in aiding ISIS?
Well, we could go through a lot of the different terrorist organizations and names. The Free Syrian Army, so-called, is supposedly the identity for the more moderate rebels, but it turns out that they barely exist as a independent entity. And that there's been quite a bit of documentation provided recently from various sources that show that most of the people that were trained by the U.S. quickly became part of the extremist organizations such as al-Nusra, the al-Qaeda organization. So long story short, there's very little difference between the so-called moderates and the so-called terrorists. They're all working together and closely, and for all practical purposes, there should be little distinction. It's very clear that the U.S. has consciously and knowingly supported terrorist organizations which they thought they could somehow use to overthrow the Syrian government, and then maybe they would try to deal with them later. But, you know, I think the real question is what's going to happen now? We seem to be at a turning point in the war. I mean, apparently the Syrian government feels that if it can decisively defeat the al-Nusra group that's ensconced in East Aleppo, that it may break the back of the rebellion. So consequently, of course, there's a hysterical reaction in the West, and which has many different manifestations, up to and including an Abbas petition now that's circulating calling for a no-fly zone in Syria. We know what that means, a major escalation of the war. Hillary Clinton is promising a major escalation of the war. Obama himself is under pressure to escalate the war. There's an incredible propaganda effort, and I really think that we're going to have a hard time mobilizing serious opposition to the war until we expose and cut through the incredible propaganda effort that's going on. And I really can't blame anybody for being fooled, because everywhere you turn, it may be the most effective propaganda, psychological warfare effort ever, seriously.
Including on the left as well, including on Pacifica stations, I have heard them being pro-Syrian intervention. So
even there, and then you have this whole white helmets phenomenon who are being heroized and promoted for the Nobel Peace Prize. There's a lot to deal with. People need to see through that. They need to cut through that. They need to find alternative sources of information, and
Jerry,
they need to mobilize to oppose. Jerry, we're
out of time. Here's what I'm suggesting. I am suggesting that this audience who wants to be up to date on the articles, the action, the call to action, go to uspeacecouncil.org for information, and also to go up and see what the U.S. Peace Council is doing with all of its members, because they're at the cutting edge. They're doing the field work. They're doing the analysis. And it's your insights, Henry Lowendorf, and your insights, Jerry Condon, that are helping us understand how to become involved, because you're telling us the truth the mainstream media fears to share with us. And I thank you both for your courage and for your commitment to this great cause.
Thank you.
Thank you, Gary. Great job.
I'm Gary Knoll, and this is the conclusion of our program today. Thank you for listening to the Progressive Commentary Hour, and please become involved. Support these important organizations.